Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Good morning. If you're a member of the Lebanese community, your heart would be in your mouth this morning. Lebanon is now firmly at the centre of the war of the Middle East, and it's certainly the key to the increasingly shaky ceasefire. Just a day since we were talking about it and when it was announced yesterday. Israeli forces have launched their heaviest attack of the war so far overnight. Soon we're going to check in with the Lebanese community and get their reaction. I'm Mary Guerin. This is The Conversation Hour. And whether you're Lebanese and you know anyone there, even if you aren't and you don't, I'd love to know your reaction. Australia has condemned the attacks along with a slew of nations. Is that enough? Would you like to see Australia do more? And what would that be? 1300 222 774 is the number to call, or text 0437 774 774. We will get some reaction from the Lebanese community very soon. Also this hour, do you have brain fog? And if so, would you remember it? No, that's a bad joke. How would you describe it? How do you even begin to define it? Is it just what you think of, like me, when you walk into a room and you can't remember why? Is that what constitutes brain fog? It's a nebulous thing. Is it a nebulous concept as well for the scientists? Some Australian scientists are now proposing a new clinical definition that acknowledges that the presentation of brain fog, particularly in menopause, is a distinct symptom, and it's not to do with ongoing cognitive decline. They believe that if we define it better and we have more clinical studies, it's going to be better to find effective treatments. If it is self-reported, are we reliable witnesses? Do you find it hard to describe your brain fog? 1300 222 774. What are your tips for getting through brain fog? Have you got it? Do you have it in certain times of life, like I mentioned, menopause, maybe other times, maybe while doing certain jobs? What's actually helped you? 1300 222 774. We will have a guest who can help you, so keep that line in mind. Ring it and tell us how we should be defining the fog and how you define it and why that is important. Also this hour, you'll want to phone in for this. The cost of living and fuel crisis have brought some of those good old retro analog household heroes to the fore. In the past few weeks, we've been talking about the rise of the humble pushy. The good old-fashioned walking trip is back in vogue. Today, I want to celebrate the vindication of the veggie patch. Nurseries have been reporting a surge in people buying seeds and equipment. Of course, to have that relief in the pocket. But also, maybe it's just fun. Right, I want to hear from you. 1300 222 774. As self-sufficiency becomes the byword of these times, you gurus of the garden, I want to hear from you. You're coming into your own. Tell us about your veggie patch. How long have you had it? Maybe you're just starting out. What would be your tips for anyone who is starting out? 1300 222 774. Brag about your broccoli. Carp on about your capsicum. I'd love to know. Maybe you've even got a question. Stick around because Carolyn Blackman will join us, the delightful Carolyn Blackman. She will tell you everything you need to know if you do have a question about it. I want to know what you're planting. I need some advice myself. Also, later in the hour, we're going to check out who to look out for when the starter pistol is fired today on the Athletics Nationals competition. Are you looking out for Jess Hull, Gout Gout and all the rest, all those other stars? But next, it is 9 minutes past 11. How is our Lebanese community feeling this morning and what do they want Australia to do?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
So the news this morning was that Israeli forces attacks on Lebanon killed at least 254 people, injuring at least 1,165 across Lebanon. The UN has called the strikes horrific. The Red Cross is outraged. Iran and the deal brokers in Pakistan said Lebanon was supposed to be part of that ceasefire that we just heard about yesterday. The US, should I say, and Israel say it never was. Joining me now is Jamal Kia, who is Lebanese Muslim Association Secretary. Thank you for joining us, Jamal.
Thank you, Mary. Thank you for having me.
What is your reaction as you wake to that news overnight?
Well, not to be sarcastic, but it's very interesting, a segue to brain fog. It seems that the whole world is suffering from amnesia at the moment. We've just saw a plausible genocide happening in Gaza, and we're just sitting by idly while a plausible genocide is about to take place in Lebanon. It's the community is just so frustrated at the lack of international will to address what is blatantly a violation of every international law. Yet we keep on seeing it escalate and escalate.
We know that this is the heaviest fighting of this war so far. Tell me, Jamal, what you're hearing from the ground. Do you know people who are over there, and what's their situation?
Oh, look, we've got family, myself personally, and the association has many, many community members who have family there. We're suffering extensively, both here and over there, mentally and physically. Lebanon is already going through an economic crisis pre this war. So even pre this war, the electricity was limited to 6 to 7 hours per day. That is now being rationed down to 1 to 2 hours per day. On top of that, you've got 1 million displaced people in the size of half of Tasmania now congregated into the half of Tasmania. Now,
do you have family there, Jamal? And what are they saying?
Oh, yeah. Sorry, we do. I do personally in the north. And the common problem that we're told is that they're reluctant to take in people from the south because they can then become a target because they don't know who the Israelis are targeting. So potentially they could accommodate someone from the south who's displaced, but then they become a target because that person is a wanted person.
So is your family sheltering or weighing that up?
Oh, I've got family who are sheltering many, many people from the south. I've got family and friends who tell me that they're overrun. They're putting tents up in their grounds. There's people putting tents up on the beaches. I've got a drastic story where a lady gave birth on the street because there was nowhere for her to go.
And are you finding it hard to even communicate with your family members, Jamal?
Well, I mean, I don't want to sort of make it sound too sarcastic, but I mean, people are reluctant to call on mobiles given the what they experienced last time in Lebanon with the walkie-talkies. So, you know, the internet is very limited, just like the electricity supply, but there is communication channels that is there, but there's just a sense of forlorn frustration because the only aid they need right now is financial, and everyone through the world, and including people in Australia, are going through an economic crisis themselves through financial hardship. But that burden of keeping the family under a roof in Australia is also duplicated by assisting family in Lebanon financially.
You're listening to Jamal Kia, who is Lebanese Muslim Association Secretary. We're talking about the attacks on Lebanon from Israeli forces overnight, which is very much putting the very young ceasefire on shaky ground. Saskia has texted in, Jamal, saying, sending strength and empathy to Jamal. I can hear the pain in his voice, and I'm sorry that we failed so badly, the people of Lebanon and Gaza. Jamal, are you finding that you have support in the community?
How do I say this nicely? Look, there is a sense of frustration within Australia, and I can understand that. This is a war going on, you know, half the world away. If you then put that on top of what the unfortunate and, you know, the disgusting episode that happened in Bondi, which is disgraceful in every sense of the word, there's been a lot of sort of anger and venom aimed at the Lebanese Muslim community in Australia. But generally, look, we find the Australians are very supportive, and they've seen this play out for the last 3 years in Gaza, and now we've got support from the community in fear of what's going to happen to Lebanon next.
It's 14 minutes past 11. Overnight, Jamal, Australia did issue a joint statement with Brazil, Colombia, Indonesia, Jordan, Sierra Leone and the UK condemning all of this. And Penny Wong, the Foreign Affairs Minister, spoke this morning on Radio National. Let's have a little listen to what she said about it.
if fighting continues in Lebanon, if Israel continues to not observe the ceasefire, there is a risk the ceasefire across the region will be at risk. And we don't want that. We want the ceasefire to hold. We know it's fragile. We know what it means for the world, and we know what it means for Australians at the petrol bowser.
Jamal Keir, are you happy with the Australian government's response?
Absolutely not. Look, we've heard these shallow words, and I'm not talking just about the Australian government. As I said from the outset, the world is suffering from amnesia at the moment. You know, we're sick of talk. You know,
what can Australia do, Jamal? I guess that's what people ask.
It's signed up to international treaties in terms of the UN. Why isn't it putting pressure in the UN? Why isn't it using its alliance with the US in order to put pressure on the US to call for a ceasefire in Lebanon? I mean, the only way we're going to stop this is by Australia using its alliance with the US in order to put more added pressure on the US government to call for a ceasefire. Lebanon has been dragged into a war unwittingly. Yet the ceasefire seems to have involved the parties that were in the war, and Lebanon's now the one bearing the brunt on its own.
You don't believe
left abandoned by the world.
You don't believe that the Australian government might be using its diplomatic pressure behind the scenes?
I certainly hope it is. We're putting that pressure on government to make sure that they are. It would be reassuring if the government came out and said that they're using all means necessary in order to put pressure on the Americans and the UN to enforce. Not just look. The issue we've got at the moment is the world has to stand up and stand for something in order to stop the Israeli aggression. Mm. Otherwise, we are going down, sadly, the stage of a World War III. When will the world stand up and say, look, the Israeli aggression's got to stop? We've got to call for a ceasefire.
You're listening to Jamal Keir, Lebanese Muslim Association Secretary. We're talking about what's happening in Lebanon and with this ceasefire. Just moments ago, Jamal, the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, was speaking to the media in Brisbane. And this is what he said about the ceasefire, saying any ceasefire must include Lebanon.
This is an important step forward. Of course, it is a fragile peace, but we want it to lead to an agreement. The Australian government also firmly believes that this has to apply to Lebanon as well.
Jamal Keir, your reaction? You'd welcome those words?
Of course I do. But again, with all due respect, Mary, those words were used identically in relation to Gaza. 70,000 dead people later, where has that led Gaza? Now, it's time that we stop talking the talk and start walking the walk if we believe in anything called international law. When do we stop saying we call for a ceasefire and start demanding it through the same international law that we all signed up to? That's what we're calling for.
Before I let you go, Jamal, I've got this on text from Brenda in Preston saying, what can the average Aussie do? What would you say to Brenda?
Honestly, right now, I think the best thing that we can do is, one, keep them in our prayers. And obviously, they need aid. So any way that we can get aid across to the Lebanese and to Palestine and Gaza as well, the same thing. But right now, prayers, goodwill and financial aid.
Jamal Keir, thank you for giving us an insight into how your community is feeling this morning.
Thank you so much. Thank you for giving me the opportunity.
That's Jamal Keir, who is Lebanese Muslim Association Secretary. It's 18 minutes past 11. And we will be keeping an eye on those developing events, obviously, in the Middle East as we go through this hour. Joe, you've called from Drysdale. What did you want to say?
Mary, just I'd like to say to Jamal, I really feel for him and his community, but I would like to see more prominent Jewish Australians speak out against what is happening in Israel, because they're silent.
Yeah, you don't believe they've said enough?
No, I don't believe they have. I think we all have to condemn what happened in Gaza and what is going on now as political. It's awful.
Joe, thank you for calling in. We will continue this conversation throughout the hour. We thought it was important to touch base with the Lebanese community this morning, and there's a lot of passion here on the text line as well, and we will get to more of that. Stick around. We're going to be talking about veggie patches, and I know you want to brag about yours. You might have questions as well. Gardening expert Carolyn Blackman will be here. So 1300 222 774, if you wanted to hop on the line even this early. But also, we're talking about brain fog. Very soon, we're going to be talking about whether or not you can define it, how that we should be defining it, and in particular when it comes to menopausal brain fog, the key to understanding that it's not ongoing brain cognitive decline. This is going to be important for all of us. Danny in Dalesford, you have brain fog. What's been your experience of it?
Well, it's really timely that this topic has come up because I've been impatiently waiting for a hip replacement for the last maybe 15 or 16 months. And in the meantime, the pain is getting pretty unbearable. So I've been put on painkillers, and one of the more recent painkillers I've been using over the last couple of months really does bring on brain fog. And I work full time, and I've found it becoming more and more embarrassing at work, forgetting things, misplacing things, not turning up to meetings on time, things like that. You know, like looking around in the staff area and thinking, where is everybody? Oh, we've got a meeting, you know. And I have to keep continually apologising to my colleagues. And it is getting really frustrating because I feel that they're judging me as being incompetent.
Danny, I'm sure your experience, you know, is common for a lot of people, and it, all the more frustrating when you take getting it through medication that you actually need. Thank you for calling in. I will put it to Carolyn Gervich, who's going to be joining us soon, talking about her research when it comes to brain fog for menopause, but more generally as well, what we can do about brain fog. I'll put that to her, Danny. And Diane in Belgrave, what's been your experience?
I've been diagnosed with brain fog that's associated with fibromyalgia, so it's often referred to as fibro fog. And I have a inflammatory arthritis, which I believe contributes as well. So my experience has been that the medical profession, and I've got a great team, but they see it as just being tired, but it affects me in terms of what's referred to as executive functioning. So the thinking, the planning, the organising, it just becomes overwhelming. And I guess a good example is I realised this week that my washing machine is leaking and I need to attend to it. But the ability to find someone and to organise it is just too much when I have a bad day. And I found the other thing too is that I think a lot of us were brought up with the sense of just pulling up your socks and getting on with it and pushing through stuff.
Yeah.
And one of the best things I've learned is that you can't do that. It just gets worse. And often I've described it as brain bog because you just get sucked down by it.
But attempting to do more is worse.
Yeah, and so I've had to realise that some days it just have to be rest days and nothing else. And it has, like your caller from Dalesford, it's actually meant that I've had to give up work. And I'm really, you know, when we hear stories overseas with war zones, I'm really grateful that I'm a lot better off than other people, and I've been eligible for the disability pension and therefore able to give up work.
Yeah,
and that's really helped in that I can pace it, and I can just accept that some days I just can't push through it, list of to do just gets shorter.
Yeah, exactly.
And how it is.
Brain bog be part of the answer. Diane, thank you for calling in. I will put it to my next guest, who's an expert in this area, whether rest actually does help. Maybe that acceptance that you're talking about really does help. It is 23 minutes past 11. Keep those calls coming in, 1300 222 774, about brain fog. We're going to hear from the expert.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is the Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
It's 24 minutes past 11. How do we define brain fog? How does one define brain fog? And how can that help us? Joining me now is the clinical neuropsychologist and associate professor at the Her centre in Monash University, Caroline Gervich. She was leading in this study that we're talking about this morning. Hello, Caroline.
Hello, Mary.
So we're talking about defining brain fog. You and your colleagues at between Monash and University of Melbourne and University College London have come up with a definition of brain fog in menopause. Let's take one step back. Why was that necessary?
So brain fog is something that a lot of people describe across lots of different conditions, like we just heard from Danny in context of pain and Diane in the context of fibromyalgia. But in the context of menopause, we wanted to define the cognitive symptoms because we feel like this will help us progress research. It will help in clinical settings if we have a clear definition of what the cognitive symptoms of menopause are. So that's what made us decide that it's time for a good definition.
And so what is the nub of your definition? What makes it different?
So we describe it as a self-reported impairment in one or more cognitive areas. So cognitive areas are things like memory, attention, organisation, but in the absence of a notable objective cognitive decline. So that means that there is no significant change if someone goes to get their cognition assessed. Generally, people perform within expected ranges. So it's a self-reported or perceived cognitive difficulty. And we also note that the cognitive symptoms can fluctuate. That might be daily, or it might be across someone's menstrual cycle if they still have one. And it can cause mild to substantial distress. So we acknowledge that while there's no significant decline objectively, it can still be quite distressing for people, and it can have an impact on people's self-esteem and their quality of life, but it's not resulting in a change for someone's capacity to perform activities of daily living. So this differentiates the cognitive symptoms of menopause from something like a dementia, where there is an impact on someone's capacity to perform whatever they do during the day.
So on one hand, you have the comfort of knowing that there's not an ongoing cognitive decline there, but there's an acknowledgement within the medical world that it is very distressing. Is that an indication that the medical world hasn't trusted self-reporting in this case?
Sometimes some people get dismissed when they talk about cognitive symptoms, or they get told that, you know, have some rest, for example, and it should be okay. And for someone, when it's impacted their self-esteem and it might have impacted their confidence, that can be quite distressing. So we do really want people to acknowledge that this is a very real symptom for many women. Mm. And we feel like having a good definition will help with that.
1300 222 774, if you have any questions or observations about brain fog, whether it's in menopause or beyond as well. We were hearing from Danny from Daylesford there, who has got it through medication. I'll ask you about that in a moment, Caroline. But 1300 222 774 is the number to call, or text 0437 774 774. It's 28 minutes past 11. So yes, going back to Danny, if we can step away from the menopausal brain fog just for the moment, the ones that are brought on by medication that you can't avoid, how does that sort of compare to other types of brain fog, whether it be menopausal or not? Is it the same principle? You just have to be able to effectively handle it, but can't do anything about it to stop it?
Sometimes, yes, you have to be able to manage it, and it's difficult to stop. But sometimes there is actually cognitive changes at an objective level, and it might indicate something more sinister. So sometimes it is worth exploring it if it's impacting your day-to-day life. And sometimes there can be changes in medication as well, so you don't necessarily have to just suffer and put up with it. So it really depends on what's underpinning the brain fog or the cognitive symptoms.
Mm. Carolyn Gervich is the lead researcher of this new study that we're talking about, that is a joint effort between Monash, Melbourne and the University of College of London. And we're talking about brain fog and how we define it. Tell me if you've got any tips for getting through it. 1300 222 774. Caroline, we heard before from Diane in Belgrave, who talked about the role, I guess, of resting. And you were mentioning as well that is often, maybe a GP will recommend that as well. What is the role of resting when it comes to brain fog, and I guess acceptance that you can't do too much?
Yeah, so I think rest and sleep are really important. So anyone knows if you've had a poor night's sleep, it can impact your capacity to think clearly. So sleep is really important, and it's important to address, and there are lots of things people can do to help their sleep. And also sometimes acknowledging you don't want to juggle too much in your mind at one time. And so sometimes you do need to take a step back, take a rest. and try and do one thing at a time, so you're not juggling multiple things. So there are practical things that you can do, and rest is one of them, but sometimes it doesn't solve everything.
We're getting lots of texts here, Caroline, if I can put some to you. Talking about the impact as well, Shauna is saying that she's had to retire early and live off savings and heading into acupuncture treatment for exhaustion, pain and brain fog. Mm. How much of an impact does brain fog have on people's lives?
It can have a really substantial impact. So it can impact someone's self-esteem and their confidence, and it can result in people stepping down from roles or stepping back from work altogether. And sometimes that isn't necessary. So sometimes in the context of menopause, for example, there might be things that could be really helpful, like hormone therapies or different strategies that people can put into place that might kind of save them and get them through what might be a temporary change in cognitive symptoms. But then for other people, if they can't find things to help and can't put practical strategies into place, it can have a really significant impact and be quite disabling for people.
Hmm. It's 29 minutes to 12. We're talking about brain fog, in particular when it comes to menopause. Anne from Rosanna says, I used to describe my menopausal brain fog like having a woolly hat on my brain, quite different from the vagueness of ageing. Is that part of your research? Is that borne out in your research, Caroline?
Yeah, it is. It is different to what happens generally during ageing. So as we age, our cognition doesn't specifically decline. There are certain areas that might not be as fast or sharp, but we don't necessarily experience brain fog more and more as we get older. For people across the menopause transition, it seems to peak, but then to potentially bounce back in postmenopausal years, as in cognitive complaints tend to peak and then improve postmenopausal. So it's not just aging, it is different. So I quite like that, woolly hat over the brain analogy. I think that kind of sums up what a lot of women describe.
Absolutely. Is it to do with me walking into a room and not remembering why, Caroline?
Yeah, that's exactly one of the things that, yes, people talk about. So which people can experience it any point in their life, but it just seems to happen more frequently during menopause or during other medical conditions as well that are associated with brain fog.
For those of us who are lucky enough to go beyond menopause, is it something then that just goes away?
It seems to. We think that the brain kind of adapts to the new levels or lower levels of estrogen in the brain, or the changes that happen during menopause in terms of hormones. So we think our brains adapt, and for most people it does seem to bounce back, and people seem to be able to, or don't seem to experience brain fog in the postmenopausal years as much as they do during the menopause transition years.
Mm. And so if you had some tips for people, what should they do? You were talking about sleep. What else?
Exercise is a really helpful strategy for improving cognition in the short term, but also in terms of long-term and healthy brain aging. Another important thing is, if it is bothering you, go and speak to your GP about different options, because there are things out there like hormone therapy that might be helpful for you. There can be really practical strategies like not juggling too much in your mind. So, you know, writing lists, doing one thing at a time, breaking down tasks so they're not overwhelming. So those practical things can also be really helpful, getting people to put things you need to do at work into an email rather than shouting it out to you in the corridor, so you don't have to, again, hold it in your mind. So there are practical things, and then there are lifestyle things that you can do. But if it's bothering you, definitely go and have a chat to your GP.
One last text without notice, Caroline. Angie is saying gut health.
Mm.
Does that work for you as well?
Yes, absolutely. There's lots of research now about the gut-brain connections and the importance of diet and different types of diet. So in terms of cognition, the diet that has the most beneficial evidence is the Mediterranean diet. So, you know, healthy eating is also really important.
And it's delicious as well. Caroline Gervich, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Mary.
That's Caroline Gervich, who is clinical neuropsychologist, is that a symptom of brain fog? And associate professor at Monash University, talking about that study. Shout out to Tony from Woodside, yes, for your text on brain fog. I believe we all get it when you get older. Just give me a minute to tell you why I have to think about it. Good on you, Tony.
tell you what you don't have to think about. 1300 222 774. You've heard that number. You'll want to get on it if you have any questions about the veggie garden. Yes, self-sufficiency is the byword at the moment because of cost of living, because of the cost of fuel, and maybe we just really like it. Get back to those retro times of fruit and veggie patches. I want to hear from you. How long have you had your fruit and veggie patch? What are you growing right now? Tell someone, maybe like me, who's just lacking a bit of confidence about how to start and what to start with. What should I be doing? 1300 222 774. And also, if you have any questions, joining me after this break is Carolyn Blackman. She can answer anything.
Get your footy fix with ABC AFL Daily Podcast. Corbin Middlemass and Ben Cameron are joined by a cast of AFL legends to pull apart the biggest stories in Aussie rules. Search for the ABC AFL Daily Podcast on ABC Listen. On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Stick with me this hour. We will be talking about the Australian National Championships kicking off. We've got a few stars to be watching there. We're going to give you all of the cheat sheets for any conversations you're having about that. That's coming up. But now we are talking about the humble veggie patch, or is it? People who have some very fancy ones out there. We're believing that nurseries are reporting a surge in people buying seeds and equipment to get their own fruit and veggies in their backyards as the price of everything is skyrocketing. Carolyn Blackman, who is gardening expert from Vivid Designs and one of 774's favourite gardeners, joins me now to talk about the veggie patch. Hi, Carolyn.
G'day, Mary. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, I can only imagine your veggie patch, Carolyn.
It's not too bad. The kids are sick of the zucchinis, though.
Do they grow too big? Isn't that the thing with zucchinis?
I've got to pick them so regularly. The neighbours might also be getting sick of the zucchinis, but it is part of the joy of overproduction is sharing it with other people, and that's a pretty good thing to do.
Have you been noticing a rise in people's interest in doing this?
We've been noticing it anyway, but I think it's kind of ramped up just in this last 6 months. It's really interesting. It's history repeating itself probably. You would have heard that in wartime, sort of in the early 40s, there was a whole campaign around Dig for Victory, and it was all about, was sort of a civil-led, really, but it was supported at all levels of government, to getting people to grow their own, because it was to do with supporting the war. It was to do with, the war effort and all the fuel that was being used and all the resources that were being taken up. And it was massive. Millions and millions of people started growing their own food, and they were sort of turning over lawn areas and their pretty front gardens and all sorts of things. But they reduced their use of resources to ship food around the country by 40%.
40%?
Massive for produce.
Dig for Victory.
So many people embraced it. It was called Dig for Victory. You can look it up. But there is an element of history repeating itself. And one of the really interesting things that came out of that they knew at that time, people had such high levels of anxiety. There were family members that had gone off to war. The information, they were only getting small amounts of information. There was a huge degree of anxiety. And the gardening and the coming together for the communities to garden all together gave such a sense of camaraderie, contribution. It actually it helped with anxiety levels, which is kind of not surprising to me at all.
Not at all. If you know that you can just walk out into the backyard and get basically the basics for your meal, let me know. 1300 222 774. If that's something that you're actually thinking about, or maybe you haven't thought about doing it before now, and current world events are prompting you to think about it. 1300 222 774. Maybe you've even been. You remember the Dig for Victory, and if it wasn't you, it were your parents, and maybe they kept it up. I'd love to hear from people who've got really long-running fruit and veggie patches. Tell me your experiences, 1300 222 774. Carolyn Blackman is with you. She can answer all of your questions as well. This on text, actually. You will know that this is a perennial question, Carolyn. Any ideas on how to deter possums? My cauliflower and cabbage hearts have been eaten. That's from Heather.
Yeah, so they are a perpetual problem. And the thing to know about possums is, I mean, they're all just trying to make a living like the rest of us. But the thing about possums is once they're onto something, they just don't let go. They just stick to it. So you, it's very, very difficult to deter them with any other means other than, you know, physically putting up a barrier. So for a lot of people, that is a fairly simple frame covered with chicken wire. And they, you know, would just build them and erect them for a time when the vegetables are kind of at their most vulnerable and shift them around. Some people do more elaborate, kind of larger scaled kind of frames, but mesh is a good idea for not just the possums, but also the rats, which is kind of almost the next part of the sentence.
Yes, that's right. We've talked about rats before, haven't we? So the frame, does that have to be a roof on that frame as well?
Yes, you can't just... So the possums don't like things that are wobbly. So if you can't build something with a roof on it and you can only have the resources or you've only got the means to build something with walls on it, make the sides of it as floppy as you can, not as well built as you can. Make it really floppy because they can't stand the feeling of it being a bit wobbly under their feet, and they'll hopefully go and, you know, enjoy someone else's garden rather than your precious vegetables. So if you are going to just... The roofs are good. Ceiling, a roof over the top is good. Obviously, it needs to be quite tall if you're going to get in underneath it as well. But if you can't do that, floppy sides, Mary.
Floppy sides. Or if it's just a smaller bed... How do you do it so that you can, do you lift the lid off? I mean, that would be hard to do, wouldn't you? If it's just a smaller bed, what do you do?
So if it's a small bed and you had, say, strawberries in it, you can actually make a very simple frame that's about 300 or 400 high with very light pine and two hinges. So you've actually got a lid for that section that pops up. But many, many people are now using bird netting. You've got to get a wildlife safe bird netting. Liz Walker from the RSPCA reminds me of that, and we're on board with it. You've got to get the wildlife safe bird netting, but many people are making very simple frames with polytube over the top, and they make like the shape of one of those old Western wagons, you know? And they're covering it with bird net and using a series of ocky straps around the bottom of their beds, and that can also deter possums and rats. But you're also picking up the birds and possibly even some cabbage moth and things, because the aperture of that net's, you know, can actually stop some of your pollinating insects, which is a problem, but also can stop other insects that are a problem. So it's one of those things that, depending on what you're growing, thinking about netting and marrying that up with what you're trying to grow is also often a way to navigate that.
Mm. You're listening to Carolyn Blackman, gardening expert. We're talking about the rise of the veggie patch, vindication for the veggie patch gurus out there, feeling very happy and smug, I'm sure, as cost of living goes up. I'm not saying smug. Satisfied.
No,
satisfied.
And maybe feeling like they've got a wee bit of control in a situation that's kind of everything's a bit out of control. And I get that.
Absolutely. That's what it's all about. It's about building the resilience. So we're not afraid. We're just cautious and we're building in those contingencies. You were talking before about digging for victory. Yes. Ross from Flemington said that your guest has forgotten that during the war people actually had a backyard. It's hard to plant veggies on a paved patio. What would you say to Ross?
Oh, well, there's small way. Obviously, yes, it's completely changed. But that Dig for Victory campaign was public parks, schools, roadsides. It was not just in people's back gardens and front gardens. It was a whole community effort. But yes, I take the point. Yes, there's smaller spaces now for people that are living in built-up areas. But there's lots of people that listen to this program that aren't in those really built-up areas too. But yes, small pots on sunny balconies could even provide you with herbs, leafy vegetables for picking for salads and things like that. So you might have rocket, you might have spinach, you might have some perpetual lettuce and a series of herbs. And maybe you can just do that in small pots on your very small paved balcony and still feel like you're, you know, having some sort of contribution to this idea of, well, I'm going to make that for dinner tonight. We're kind of letting what we have choose what we're having for dinner, rather than this situation where we've become very conditioned to being able to get a red bell pepper at any time of the year. We don't grow red bell peppers in Victoria throughout the whole year. They're a summer crop for us. But we as consumers have become very conditioned to being able to get them, and that means fuel and that means shipping a lot of stuff around a very large country. So us thinking about being more garden-led with how we're going to cook rather than what am I going to cook and how will I find it, that's another bit of a mindset shift that is quite good for people to start thinking about.
Yeah, and it gets your brain thinking on a different level as well. 1300 222 774 if you have any questions about your veggie patch, if you have any tips for people who are starting veggie patches as well. This from Stacey, who's loving the chat. I can highly recommend using heirloom seeds from Diggers Club and letting things go to seed, says Stacey. Mm-hmm. We have surplus dill, parsley and old-fashioned spinach, a great crop, and we've let it go to seed many times and have a constant crop. Now, I'm really interested in that, Stacey and Carolyn, because I inadvertently let things go to seed. But are you saying that it's a good thing?
Yes, absolutely. So in the vegetable patch, at the moment I've got probably 3,000 parsley seedlings in our vegetable garden and under the trampoline and in little sections of the front garden where I brought a plant. I'm not going to let them all grow, but I am never going to run out of parsley either. So I let them come where they can. I get rid of them where they're in the way and I just chop them down with my little flat Dutch hoe and I just leave them there. So, and then the next time you go to plant, you know, the space will be taken up by the actual thing that you want to have growing. So I've got lots and lots of that action going on in our space as well. And I'm all for it. It's fine.
Good. That is good news for people like me. This on text, join it.
Which is kind of the order of the day as well. It's free. It is free.
It is free. Free plants. And they go where they want. There are multiple calls on text for joining community gardens. And I guess that's what also you're pointing to as well. Part of that patriotic push once is just about connection, isn't it?
It's so about connection. It's about a feeling of empowerment and having some control. It's about connection with other people. It's about sharing that produce that you've created and maybe swapping that with somebody else who grew beans, but you grew the peas, and, you know, then each having a swap over and having that little bit more variety. Coming together to do those community gardens often offers people more scope. So for people like our caller that rang and said we've only got a tiny paved courtyard, it offers them the scope to broaden the things that they would be able to grow. And so I couldn't recommend it more. And the way that a garden, I've never seen anything quite so powerful as a community garden to bring people that don't share language together in a way that they can hear a whole bunch of communication that's nothing to do with the actual language that's being spoken, but lots of good communication going on between different cultures and different languages. And there's not many things that can do that, but gardening can.
Absolutely. It is 12 minutes to 12. Sandy, you've called in from Sale. Do you have a veggie garden?
I do have a veggie garden. I've always had a veggie garden from a teenager onwards.
Wonderful.
So I just really wanted to quickly comment about all of the advantages with having or growing your own food.
Please go.
So I find that I exercise every day. It might not be for hours on end, but I'm, you know, if I go out in the veggie garden, I'm exercising.
It's
also good. It is, yeah, good for your brain matter because you're always thinking about, well, when do I need to plant these seeds? You know, how's the best way to get the optimum growth? Thinking ahead all the time. But also it kind of forces you to eat healthy because you put a lot of work into your veggie garden and it doesn't even have to be a lot of work, you know, if it's a small veggie garden, but it really forces you to eat healthy because you don't want to waste that food and that effort that you've put in.
So I couldn't agree more.
I cannot think of one disadvantage of having your own veggie garden, no matter what size.
Sandy, what would you have to say to, and you, Caroline, as well, for people who have just lack a bit of confidence?
Look, there is so much personally. I think there is so much information out there nowadays. You just jump on Google, talk to your nursery person. You can always find out information and then it's just having a go. And, you know, what's the worst thing that can happen? Your beetroot might not be as big as you'd like.
And that's about the worst of it, isn't it? That the possums are going to get something or something doesn't look quite as picture perfect as it does in the shops. But what you're getting from that is that food that you know that hasn't been sprayed, food that's diverse, we know it's good for our gut biome, we know there's a whole bunch of other reasons to do that. So I couldn't agree with you more. And the only other thing that I would just add to that
is if people have never grown things that are productive before, you need at least 6 or 8 hours of sun, okay? Don't plant them in the shade and then go, oh, I'm not a good gardener. That breaks my heart about people going, I'm not good at this. 6 to 8 hours of sun gives you the best fighting chance. And then the second thing I would start with is just really easy things. Silver beet, chard, spinach, perpetual lettuce that I spoke about before. I'd have a crack with some broccoli and some of the bunching broccoli. And then I would work my way up to things like carrots or spuds. But I start with the quick leafies because you will be eating from your seedlings in about 4 weeks and you'll be eating from seed in about 8 weeks.
That is the sort of stuff I need to know. I am writing it down. So start with broccoli. That's fantastic because that's popular in my household. Sandy, thank you for calling. You're one of the gardening gurus that we are being inspired by here. We're talking about veggie patches, the rise and rise of them in these troubled times. Rosa is asking you, Carolyn, top tips for beginners starting raised veggie beds.
Sure.
I guess part of what you're saying before is pick a good spot. It has to have 6 hours of sunlight. It doesn't have to be the biggest, the hottest part of, I guess, during winter. You've got no choice. Just need sunlight. Is that right?
North facing is good, but if you have it up against a fence, even if you're north facing, it will be so shaded in the winter.
Right.
And that's not ideal. So you need to kind of go out and have a look around your garden and just observe it and find the spots that are getting at least 6 to 8 hours of sun. And it might be that your best spot is actually north-facing but up against the house rather than the fence, or west-facing for you but in the more open area so that it's getting most of the north sun during the day and then plenty in the afternoon. Just observe and you need sun. Now, the other thing to say about raised beds is they do make life easier. They're easier to garden and they're often easier to manage, and often easier to manage with pests as well as weeds. The caveat on them is that they can dry out a little faster because they're raised.
Mm.
So I would encourage people to research wicking beds, which are kind of like a great big self-watering pot. If anybody's ever used a self-watering pot for their indoors, it's the same concept. So you're getting an osmotic effect of drawing up moisture from a reservoir below. Now, if you're not confident with watering, it's kind of taking a bit of that worry and anxiety out of overwatering or underwatering, because the plants, the soil moisture levels draw up what they need rather than you just putting on water anyway, or you forgetting to water and then having everything run to seed because it's become too stressed. So wicking beds are a very, if you're just building new raised beds, now, I would be seriously encouraging you to research wicking beds if you're going to build raised beds.
And are those the type that you can see the water level, you know, with
you
your eyes?
You can see it's underneath, but they've got like a little tube, Mary, so that if you, so say there's too much rain, the tube can be set in such a way that any excess rain flows out over the edge. And they've got a little means of the reservoir at the bottom, whilst concealed, you can put the hose in it. Hopefully people have got tanks, and that's another thing, tanks and things at the moment that they're feeling that they can use the water because everything's going up, including utilities. People hopefully are putting in tanks, but you can fill up the reservoir until that little tap section, that little overflow pipe runs, and then you know that the reservoir is full, and then you can really forget about it for maybe even a week or longer, depending on what you're growing, what aspect it's in, how much wind it's receiving, and what your soil substrate's like. So,
yeah, there's so much inspiration there. A final word from Lynn in Frankston. You've had one since you were a kid?
Oh, have I ever? Good morning to you both. It's just lovely to have this topic because it's taking me back to World War II when my father returned from Changi as a prisoner of war and moved in with my mother to a beautiful, brand new war service home in beautiful Blackburn, where he proceeded, after having had very little food for 3.5 years when he was incarcerated, to producing a garden with 25 varieties of fruit and vegetables.
Oh, that's fantastic. So this is stuck with you, Lynn. It is. That's a lovely story.
Thank you.
That's me. Well, that would have been what an amazing way for him to reclaim that control over that aspect of his life that he had been clearly deprived of.
Indeed.
Basic human rights of food, and he had taken control over that. My goodness. And I hope he enjoyed every delicious bite.
Carolyn, it's always such a delight to talk with you. Thank you.
Oh, thanks, Mary. Anything that gets people gardening is great, and I'm really happy to chat with everybody today.
Yeah, and everything that make anything that makes people feel a little bit less anxious as well is always terrific. Carolyn Blackman is gardening expert from Vivid Designs, giving us all lots of inspiration for veggie patches. We're coming towards the end of the hour, but you might not know that the Australian national titles are on in the athletics, and boy, have we got some stars. Simon Smale is an ABC sports reporter who's going to give you your cheat sheet. If you're in a party, you're talking about the Australian nationals, he's going to give you all of the highlights. Hi, Simon.
G'day, Mary. How are you?
Good. Jess Hull is just my hero. Of course, she's the 1500-metre specialist, but she's taken on a fair bit. It started off a bit as a joke. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. This was her, a bit of a free hit for her, something to do for fun, the 800 metres. And that's what she did at the World Championships, ended up running into a final, which was absolutely superb. And she's one of the busiest athletes globally, that I think, across any country, across any event, because she's done every single World Championships, that's indoor, outdoor, and cross-country since 2022.
Wow.
And that includes a couple of Olympics, an Olympic as well. So, yeah, she's a busy girl. She's going to be busy this weekend as well. She's doing the 8 for 15 and for 5K.
And apparently the 800 metres and the 500 metre finals are just half an hour apart on Sunday. Is that right?
An hour apart. An absolutely. Hour. So half an hour. So 800 metres will be the warm-up for the 5K, which is mind-blowing when you think about 800, especially at the level that we're talking about now. And it's a sprint. It is a flat sprint, the 800 metres. So Five Ks, you know, they can be a bit tactical. She's going to have to hope for a tactical, short and slow race, I would have thought. But who knows? She might just have the speed in her legs and might just keep going the way she's gone.
Absolutely fascinating. As I was saying, we've got so many superstars at the moment. It's a real resurgence for Australian athletics. We've got Gout Gout and Lockie Kennedy in the 200. Amazing.
Look, I mean, they had a stunning race at the Mori plant in Melbourne, a couple of weeks ago, even in the rain. It was the 22-year-old Kennedy who got the lead and the jump on 18-year-old Gout Gout. They're both going to go head-to-head again in the 200 metres, and Kennedy's going to be doing the 100 as well. Gout isn't going to be doing the 100. I think he's still managing.
What is that about?
I think he's only 18, and I think the idea is that you get powerful and you get the technique right to do the 200 as a youngster, and then you can get the man strength, if you like. You know, he still needs to grow into his body, still needs to get that strength to be able to do the 100 meters effectively. And it's just about managing that expectation. There is an awful lot of expectation on him, an awful lot of excitement around him, justifiably so. You know, world championship semi-finalist at 17 he was. So taking a breath, give him a bit of time.
Give him a bit of a break. Give him a break. And who else would you say that we should be looking out for, Simon?
Do you know what? Claudia Hollingsworth in the 800 and the 1500, genuine threat to Jess Hull. She's only 20 years old. She had a brilliant result at Mori Plant. She managed to beat the world indoor gold medalist over 800 metres, Georgia Hunter Bell. That was a great result. Really, really impressed with that. I love the thought of Peter Bol versus Cameron Myers in the 15 and the 800 as well. Middle distance running in Australia is at the absolute peak that it's ever been, really, at the moment, certainly in recent years. Cameron Myers, only 19. He's such a great race. Seeing him go up against a veteran Pete Bol is going to be brilliant. But then you have to have a look at Dan Williams as well. He's only 18 years old. He actually ran the sixth fastest time by an Australian ever at the Adelaide Invitational, 3-4 weeks ago now. So he's a really top quality athlete. Just, again, having all these youngsters coming through and really pushing the experienced players, experienced athletes, is fantastic. It's been a great time for domestic sport in Australia.
Really,
we've had
these
swimming championships this week. Last week, there was a track cycling championship. And there's Olympians coming out of the woodwork everywhere. Nina Kennedy's going to be at the athletics. Elena Patterson and Olympia and Nicola Olli-Slagers are going to be there as well in the high jump. Just so many great options.
Simon, you're right. There'll be a lot of our listeners who remember some of the heyday of athletics. And, well, pay attention because it could be coming around again. Thank you for giving us all the cheat sheet on it.
No problem at all. The good times are back.
Exactly. Simon Smale with ABC Sports. Thank you very much for joining me today in Conversation Hour. Join me again tomorrow.